Welcome, people, and thank you for tuning in. This is the Sports Underground Podcast with Barrett Graff.
And look who's coming up.
Only last week, I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick. I'm so mean, I make medicine sick.
So let's do what we do tonight.
And now, from the Hotbox Studio in Los Angeles, which is literally an 8x10 box in Barron's garage, here's your host, Barron Graft.
Hey, what is happening, folks? The Sports Underground back at it. Going in, I've missed so much. I got to get after it tonight. And it's just, I got 100 reasons and none of them good. So here's the deal. We're going to jump in and we're going to talk NFL. You can bet we're going to talk about that. Going to talk college football. We got a long ways until a meaningful game will be played in college football again soon. But listen, I'm listening to a lot of flap and a lot of static around the national championship game. I got to weigh in and clear some of this up. Got to talk about the NBA just a little bit since the season is moving into form there. And so the picture's starting to get kind of clear. And it ain't real pretty in L.A., yo. And on the backside, we're going to hold up on our commitment there. We're going to do a Major League Baseball hot stove report at the back of the show. In the NFL, wow, we are coming down the stretch. In the NFL, the playoff picture starting to come into form. There are teams that are already in. There are teams right on the outside. A lot of people looking in, and it's pretty interesting because there's a lot of teams in here that I never would have expected to see. And I don't think I'm alone. I don't think anybody expected to see the Colts at 9-4. Anybody who projected Colts at 9-4, let me see your gambling slip. Let me see your ticket from the win where you took the Colts to have a winning record this year. Let me see it. I want to see that because I don't know if I buy that. But it's pretty interesting. And, I mean, you got really, really great stories going on. Really great stories going on. The Broncos, you got a matchup sizing up where it could be, there's still a possibility that the Broncos and the Colts could meet in the first round. I mean, how do you write that? You can't make that up, folks. You just can't. The Broncos are definitely in the playoffs. The Texans are definitely in the playoffs. The Patriots are definitely in the playoffs. That makes Monday Night Football tomorrow night massively interesting. With the Texans and the Patriots knocking heads. It's, you know, that late season litmus test. Let's figure out where we're at. Let's see where we are if we're a team in Texas. In Houston, I mean. Where are you? That's on the road in New England. That's a great test. And another great test, the Sunday night game in the snow. Green Bay, Detroit. Detroit was extra motivated. They haven't won in Green Bay in something like 20 years or something. Something that makes every Lions fan want to put a gun in their mouth when they talk about it. They haven't won in Green Bay in 20 years. Wow. Wow, that's brutal. I don't know if that's true. I think they haven't won there 20 straight times. It might not be quite 20 years, but it's a long time. It goes back to pre-realignment, if that, you know, rings a bell. If you're not too young an NFL fan to remember when realignment occurred. Yikes, Lions fans. And they had it. Oh my gosh, Detroit, you had Green Bay by the short ones. Going in, up big, controlling the clock in the first half. And then it all just came crumbling down. And listen, I'm not one to jump on a bandwagon. I think you guys know that. But I will say this. I think that the Packers are quietly playing some of the best football in the league. That's a 9-4 team that realistically should be 10-3 if you remember the Seahawks debacle. that was the end of their placement officials. That's a 10-3 team, folks. Don't look at the record on paper and believe what you see. And as they so astutely noted on the Sunday Night Football broadcast, this is a team that gets Clay Matthews back next week on defense. This is a team that gets Charles Woodson back on defense soon. They had Jordy Nelson out hurt on offense. They've missed Greg Jennings this year. They've had a slew of injuries that has slowed them down. And they're 9-4 atop what I would call a pretty difficult division with the Bears there putting up a big fight. So, I'm just saying that's a massively interesting division right there. The NFC East is interesting and not really for a good reason. I mean, look, the Giants are 8-5, but with the exception of Philadelphia, nobody's out of this thing. You got the Redskins at 7-6 and the Cowboys at 7-6, both nipping at the Giants' heels, tugging at the lapels of the Seahawks, trying to get in to one of those last spots. Seahawks and Bears at 8-5 hold the wild cards in the NFC right now. And Cowboys, Redskins, RG3, bad knee injury. He could miss some time. And look, it's really interesting to watch that thing come together with Kirk Cousins, the other rookie quarterback there. That's a crazy story in Washington. That's another team that I think at the beginning of the year, look, if you told me, okay, this is a 500 football team, I'd have gone, oh, okay, I can see that. Because I believe in RG3. I like that. But the emergence of Alfred Morris, their rookie running back, you got to be excited for the future if you're a Redskins fan. That's all I'm saying. Now, you still have a racist mascot. But that's a whole other point. Let's not even get into that. Let's just put that on the back burner. And let's, despite the fact that you have one of the last and biggest, most racist mascots in sports. Besides that, very exciting times in the Beltway there. I can't believe I haven't been on the air a lot. And so just to weigh in on the 49ers at 9-3-1. Wow. I can't believe that Jim Harbaugh had the rocks to change quarterbacks. I felt like it was going to take, I knew he liked Kaepernick a little bit better, but I thought it was going to take a pretty significant fall from grace for Alex Smith to get displaced. But hey, only one guy is running a program in San Francisco, and his name's Jim Harbaugh. And give Alex Smith a lot of credit. He's handled that situation with a lot of dignity and grace. I'm not sure a lot of guys could have carried themselves with as much poise as he has. God, that's exciting if you're a Niners fan. I mean, think about that. You've got a guy who's lost two games in the last 2 years in Alex Smith. He's holding a clipboard right now. What's that tell you about how excited and what faith and belief Jim Harbaugh has in Colin Kaepernick? That's really exciting in the Bay Area right there. I mean, listen, you're talking about Jim Harbaugh. This guy's got an eye for talent. And if you don't believe me, look back into the college ranks and the Stanford team that he coached and recruited for years. And look, they're still profiting off of the recruits that he eyeballed. So if he's looking at Kaepernick and he thinks he's this good that he's willing, I mean, beyond just putting Alex Smith on the bench, think about this. This is a really, really risky move. Because if this goes sideways, the backlash is huge. I mean, he's built up enough. I think he's built up enough credibility within the organization that he could do this and it could go sideways and they go, hey, might want to put Alex back in, Jimmy. He could probably get away with this, but it's still a very risky move from a public perception aspect. You know, what you could lose in faith of the fan base is gigantic. And listen, you can ask coaches around the league. Sometimes the perception of the fan base can be just as or more important than your perception of the front office and what's actually going on in the field. I mean, look, Rex Ryan's a great example in New York with the Jets. Fan perception could have him out of a job. He's not a bad coach. He's let it get a little bit loose there for the Jets mess. But he's not a bad coach. I don't like Jason Garrett as a coach in Dallas. They squeaked out a win against the Bengals on Sunday. And I think Jason Garrett's probably gone at the end of the season if this team doesn't at least make the playoffs. And I don't know if they will. I honestly, in looking at the Cowboys, I'm not real sure how I feel about them and their chances of being the team that comes out of the NFC East. I said this is an interesting division and not necessarily in a good way. It's because I'm not sure how much I believe in this team. I mean, I like the Redskins a heck of a lot more than I do the Cowboys, and I don't like either one of them nearly as much as I like the Giants. But listen to the Cowboys' remaining opponents. They face the Steelers, which, okay, the Steelers just came off of a tough loss. Pittsburgh just absolutely got their lunch handed to them by a struggling San Diego team in Pittsburgh. That's a tough loss. Those guys might be a little more motivated when they play the Cowboys. So you got that game. Then they've got the Saints, who, you know, that's a prideful team. There's a lot more on the line than just the record in the playoffs for the Saints, who are now 5-8 and look like they're completely out of the picture. But trust me, the Saints would love to spoil the Cowboys' hopes. And then they close the season at the Redskins. Now, here's the deal. At the Redskins could be a very influential game. Because remember, you're looking up at the Seahawks and you're looking up at the Bears right now if you are the Redskins and the Cowboys. I don't realistically think catching the Giants is going to happen. Sorry, call me a skeptic. I just don't. Even though the Giants have a tough schedule at Atlanta, at Baltimore, and then home, they close with the Eagles. So I'll chalk that one up as a win. Although I will say, the Eagles love to beat the Giants. I don't know why, but even when the Eagles are bad, they manage to beat the Giants somehow. So who knows? The NFC East of all the divisions, I think, is the most wide open. I don't see the Steelers catching up with the Ravens at this point. It would take a pretty monumental collapse on the part of Baltimore and a pretty big push by the Steelers. But don't count the Bengals out of the playoff picture. I didn't know until I watched them play the Cowboys. You know, that front four is really, really strong for the Cincinnati defense. Most sacks of any front four in football. That's impressive. So let's keep our eye on Cincinnati. They're at the Eagles, at the Steelers, and versus the Ravens. That team, I think, controls their own destiny. I'm not sure how many other teams really control their own destiny besides Cincinnati. Stick around. Going to get into college football and a little bit of NBA. But first, a little Alice in Chains. Yeah. Hey, listen, I haven't been on the air since the SEC championship game between Alabama and Georgia. But wow, what a football game. I'm not kidding you. That might be the best football game I've seen in 5 years. College or pro, that might be the best football game I've seen in a couple of years. Just unreal. Back and forth. I mean, I had no idea who was going to win that game, even down to the very end. At the very end, I was thinking to myself, anybody can win this thing. This might come down to who's got the ball last. It was that kind of game. And I was really, really impressed with, more than anything, with Alabama's ability to run the ball on Georgia. I mean, you are talking about a Bulldogs defense that returned 9 starters this year. You're talking about a Georgia defense that's going to have several guys playing on Sundays. And it got me to thinking, because a lot has been made now of the national championship game, which has now set the game between Notre Dame and Alabama for the national championship. And everybody loves talking about Notre Dame, and that I've heard way too much now about Notre Dame and how they can hang. And I mean, Pat Forty wrote some piece of crap article that is so completely off base. It's laughable. It's hilarious to me that somebody who calls themselves a professional journalist would put their name on that. If you got questions on that one, hit me up. Hit the email for the show, sportsunderground@gmail.com. I've got a dissertation on why Pat Forty is full of it, if you want to read up. But yeah, it got me thinking, and I really struggle, because what I keep coming back to with Notre Dame is like, okay, yeah, you've got a good defense, good enough, I guess. And when you're looking at it from, a yards per game perspective, you got a good defense. That's cool. Points per game, that's the big one. People are looking at points per game, saying, oh, they allow the fewest points per game of any team. Listen, here's where the rubber meets the road, is the one simple fact. That's fine. You want to talk about stats? That's fine. I've got one simple question. Against who? You are talking about a Notre Dame team that has faced some really, really bad teams. Teams like Wake Forest, teams like Boston College, who are literally, in the bottom 10 in all of college football in rushing, rush yards per game. I mean, that's significant. And it's especially significant when you consider who their next opponent is in Alabama. Alabama runs the ball as well, if not better, than anybody in the country. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But what it really comes down to me is the question of against who. And I started thinking about this because the talent level of the teams that Notre Dame has faced just doesn't, on paper, looking at the names of these teams, it just, when I look and I see Boston College, when I look and I see Wake Forest, and these are their opponents, Pittsburgh, Miami, it's just looking at these teams, I'm going, Navy. I mean, how many of these teams actually have pro level talent? So I dug in. I say me. I enlisted the help of the College Football Savant, and we dug in. And all I want to know is, like, who have they really faced? Who are the guys? And so what we did, I'm going to use the royal we here. We went back and reviewed the entire 12 game schedule for Notre Dame with one criteria in mind: opponents' pro level talent. So initially we were just looking at skill positions of quarterback, running back, cornerback, wide receiver, stuff like that. And then it quickly became apparent that they had only faced a handful of players at those unique positions. So then we just opened it up to anybody. Any player on any roster that they played that's likely going to play in the NFL in the next couple of years. So here's a list of all of the players by team that they played in 2012 that are widely considered to be 2013 draft prospects. Now, it should be noted that this doesn't include underclassmen who may still develop and leave and go to the pros. But look, here's the guys who are ready to go. The first game of the season, only one guy, Brandon Turner, a wide receiver. Game two, they played Purdue. You got two guys there, Josh Johnson at quarterback, at cornerback, and Kawan Short, a defensive tackle. Game three at Michigan State, you're looking at Johnny Adams, a cornerback, Dan Conroy, a kicker, and Anthony Wright, a defensive tackle. Game four, Michigan. This team actually has a fair amount of talent. Kenny Demons at linebacker, JT Floyd at cornerback, Jordan Kovacs at safety, Patrick Omama, I hope I'm saying that right, at guard. Denard Robinson, most people are projecting him as a wide receiver in the NFL. Craig Roy, defensive end, and Roy Roundtree at wide receiver. Game five, they played Miami. Brandon McGee, the running back, is the only guy there. Game six, Stanford. Shane Cove at linebacker. Stephen Taylor at running back. Chase Thomas at linebacker. Game seven, BYU. Ezekiel Ansah at linebacker. Braden Hansen at guard. Unoa Cavalenga at linebacker. Game eight, Oklahoma. Demontre Hurst, cornerback. Lane Johnson, tackle. Landry Jones, quarterback. David King, defensive end. I'm not gonna keep slaving away at this. But what it really comes down to is that Notre Dame has faced a total of 36 players that are considered NFL prospects. And of those 36 players, only two are considered immediate starters who will be drafted in the first round. Those two players both play for USC. They're Matt Barkley and Khaled Holmes. And technically, Barkley did not play in that game. So in their entire 12-game season, Notre Dame only faced one player who's expected to be playing on Sunday next fall. And that player, the center for USC, Khaled Holmes, while he's certainly talented and skilled, he's playing center in front of a quarterback who's never had a college start before that game. So of the 34 remaining players, after you take Barkley and Holmes off the list, the 34 remaining likely draft candidate players, only 14 are considered to be even eventual starters who will most likely be drafted in the second or third round. And then these other 20 players, the other guys that are out there, are just considered draftable players who have a future, you know, holding a clipboard, warming a bench, knocking heads on special teams. That's it. That's who they've faced. That's who they've put up these gaudy numbers against. Their next opponent, that team's Alabama. We're talking about one team now. Just keep this in mind. We're talking about one team, not 12, Alabama. Alabama has 9 players on their squad that are considered NFL prospects. Of those 9 players, 3 are supposed to be first-round picks who will be immediate starters. That number of immediate NFL starters faced will double for Notre Dame in just one game. Double. And there are 2 more Alabama athletes that are considered eventual starters. So half of the NFL prospects on Alabama's roster, 5 of the 9, will be drafted in the 3rd round or sooner. So I think it's fair to say, just based on the information that's on paper, that Notre Dame has not yet played a team that's nearly as talented as Alabama. In fact, they've only seen 1 player all season who matches the general talent pool of 3 or 4 of the players on Alabama's roster. Now let's flip the coin. Let's look at Alabama's competition. And just to err on the side of caution, we only looked at the SEC. Reminder, Notre Dame faced 1 player who's considered an immediate NFL starter, Khaled Holmes, center for USC Trojans. Alabama faced 6 players just in the SEC, we're talking 9 games, 6 players who are considered immediate starters. That's it. I mean, just look at the rosters in the SEC. Look at the guys they have to face over and over and over again. Look at the roster for Georgia. Look at the roster for LSU. It quickly becomes apparent that the talent level that Notre Dame has faced is simply not on par with Alabama. And I don't say this to slight Notre Dame in any way. I mean, what? You made the schedule. You set it up to be a friendly schedule. I honestly don't think that they thought that they were going to start the Chip Kelly era and 3 years into it, they were going to be in the national championship game. I really don't think that was their anticipation. I think that Notre Dame set this schedule in an effort to give themselves an easy path. A path that they could run the table possibly, be in contention for a BCS bowl, and if the cards fell their way, they'd have a good season. But what's happened is they've wound up in the title game. Their big opponents that they play annually had down years, and their 2 marquee wins are against programs that were struggling. I mean, look, they won against Stanford. Yeah, Stanford changed their quarterback and didn't lose a game again. They won against Oklahoma. Here's news, folks. Oklahoma, not a great rushing team. And you can say whatever you want about Manti Te'o and his abilities. He's a very good player. Unfortunately, he's one guy. And when you're talking about how much Alabama's going to run the ball, I'm just not sure that Notre Dame's going to be able to hang. They haven't seen a team this big, this physical, and this talented. It's that simple. More on this to come down the road. Good stuff. Yeah. Hey, real quick, before I get into Major League Baseball, what is going on with the Lakers? I mean, this is unreal. We are talking about the team that leads the league in rebound differential. They're collecting nearly 6 rebounds per game more than their opponents. That means they're getting more chances. That means they're taking away chances on the other end for the other team's offense. And yet this is a team with a losing record, just 2-6 on the road, looking terrible, looking like they wouldn't cross the street to toss a bucket of water if one another was on fire. I mean, I don't know what's going on. It is ugly, ugly for Los Angeles. So anyways, that's a tangent. Moving over into the world of Major League Baseball, the hot stove starting to get hot. The National League West is where we're at. It's very appropriate considering what's happened in the last 24 hours. We'll get to that in a minute. The first team we're looking at, we're going to go bottom to top on this one since the Giants won the World Series. We'll start at the other end of the spectrum and go from bottom to top in the NL West. And surprisingly, I was shocked by this. I did not know that the Colorado Rockies were actually the worst team in the National League West. I thought for sure it was the Padres. Nope. Come to find out, Rockies were dead last and not even close to the playoffs. You know, and they were the second worst team in the entire National League last year. I mean, just bad. The good news in Colorado is you got nowhere to go but up or possibly sideways. What's really crazy, and not too crazy, but kind of strange, is that the Rockies actually had a great year at the dish. They finished second in batting average, fourth in slugging percentage, and sixth in on-base and runs. So, you know, big shocker, the problem in Colorado is pitching. Or they finished 30th in the following. ERA, quality starts, walks and hits per innings pitched, and opponent's batting average. Yeah, you heard me, 30th. As in, there's only 30 teams in Major League Baseball. So, yeah. They got a couple of notable free agents in the offseason. Jeff Francis, a starting pitcher, and Jason Giambi, a first baseman. Most of this team is already under contract. All the big bats like Cargo, Michael Kadire, and Troy Tulowitzki, all under contract. We don't need to go blow by blow through their roster. The team's behind the eight ball. What they really need is pitching. But the problem is, you're not going to get a premier pitcher to go toss the rock in Colorado. It's just not going to happen. So you end up looking for these lower-level hurlers, guys like Ricky Nolasco, guys like Gavin Floyd. In terms of hitters, I mean, the price is just too high for this team. They can't afford guys like Michael Bourne. They can't afford the Josh Hamiltons of the world. You get the feeling that the Rockies are going to go into spring training. Like, before pitchers and catchers even report, they're already going to be 10 games back in the West. It's going to be a rough season. I do like Walt Weiss. I hope he's going to work out as the manager there. But this is going to be a rough year, Rockies fans. Especially considering what's happening within the division, the pitching, it's just going to be a rough year. The Padres are a very, very similar situation. Last year they finished second only to the Rockies in the NL West, second to last, 76-86, another losing season. They did have the lowest payroll in all of Major League Baseball. At just $55.2 million. Just for the record, I think the Dodgers are paying three guys more than $55 million this year. And the Padres, it showed. They were just a mess pretty much everywhere. There's not really one area that's worse. It's kind of like what I imagine happens in the ER when, like, high-speed motorcycle wreck comes in. It's just like, where do you start? This is bad all over. They're pretty much at the bottom statistically of all major categories. But if you had to pick one thing to start with, pitching could be considered the Achilles heel from last year. So going into this season, the players they have under contract, they've got Curtis Maben, Carlos Quentin, Houston Street. There are a few other role players under contract, but this is the core of the returning players. They've got a long list of arbitration-ready players, more than 10. Some will stay, but most of the time, the Padres are going to lose in these rulings. And they're most likely not going to pay the salary awarded to the players, thus they're going to become free agents. The only player to note that they've already lost or are going to lose in free agency is Jason Marquis, and that's only because he's a starting pitcher. So, the biggest gain that the Padres made for this upcoming season is not on the field. It's in new ownership and a new TV deal. And that's the name of the game in Major League Baseball now. You want to know why the Dodgers are spending money like a drunken sailor on their last shore leave before they go off to war? It's because they got a TV deal in the wings. And now in San Diego, that's in place. And popular belief says that this will start to expand their payroll. And pitching is definitely going to be a priority. Most of the position players are set, ready to go. And listen, the good thing is Petco is a pitcher-friendly park. And so pitchers who might be down on their luck could be looking to go to a place like Petco to kind of get their career back on track. So you could be looking at a couple of guys out there. You know, you could be looking at names like Carlos Villanueva or Sean Markham, you know. And there is apparently some intrigue in San Diego of bringing back Jake Peavy for a swan song. His price tag might be a little too big, even for that new TV money pockets. But if they can keep the momentum, I mean, they had a pretty decent second half. They could be a team worth watching. But I don't know. I don't know if they're going to really be able to keep up with the upper echelon of this division. But I do expect them to still finish in front of the Rockies, if that means anything. Third place in the National League West in 2012 went to the Arizona Diamondbacks, who finished 81-81, dead heat .500 record. They didn't have a whole lot of payroll, $74 million in payroll. And listen, it's weird to come in third in a winnable division. You feel like that's a team that could have won that division. Injuries didn't go their way. They didn't really make any moves that were of any note during the season in terms of adding players. And listen, they hit okay. They were fourth in the National League in runs scored, sixth in home runs, but they were also fifth in strikeouts. Defensively and from a pitching perspective, look, their pitchers didn't miss a lot of bats. The opponent's batting average was .261. That's 13th in the National League. That's not great. That's 13th in the Major Leagues. That's not great. A big question mark for them all year long was at shortstop. Willie Bloomquist played the majority of games there, 61 games. That's not good. And it sounds like they're in talks with the Indians to get Asdrubal Cabrera, and this would be phenomenal. I mean, remember, if there's not a guy named Derek Jeter going to the All-Star game every year in the AL, for the last couple of years, this pretty much would have been a fight between Asdrubal Cabrera and Johnny Peralta to see who's starting at shortstop for the American League. So that would be a great sign for them. They already got Eric Chavez to play third base from the Yankees. He filled in nicely when A-Rod was out. On top of that, they added Brandon McCarthy from the A's to the pitching staff. It's going to help. Now, I don't know if it's going to be enough because the Dodgers and the Giants at the top of this division made some pretty big moves. Now, remember the Dodgers, they came in second place in the National League West last year. And realistically, you could say that their postseason kind of started with the deal with the Red Sox, because I don't think realistically you can expect that team to compete throwing that many role players into the roster at the end of the season. It's just kind of unrealistic. Their season was kind of like my golf game. It started really strong and then just a hard fade. And no matter how much the fan base, no matter how much I beg it to stay up, just stay up. It's just fading. It's going to fall off. Their 2013 outlook is insane. It's guaranteed now that their payroll is going to be over $200 million this year. That's Yankee territory, folks. And there's only 19 guys signed, and they're over $200 million. So this ain't over. Most notably, they recently signed Zach Greinke to a six-year, $147 million deal. They also picked up some Korean right-hander named Hyun-Jin Ryu, $36 million over 6 years. Got to pay something like $25 million to sign him. It definitely makes this team a contender. And if Hanley Ramirez at shortstop can return to his 2009 form, that's huge. I still don't know who's playing third base, but with a wealth of starting pitchers pushing the rotation into the bully, it looks great in Los Angeles for the Dodgers. And that brings us to the world champion San Francisco Giants. And this is the weird thing, right? Because this team wins the World Series and they do it according to their model. It's all patched up, barely scoring enough runs to win, hanging on by duct tape and bubblegum. And in the offseason, the only significant things that they've done, and they're pretty big, is they re-signed Angel Pagan and Marco Scudero. Now that's huge. They've also released Brian Wilson, their former closer, which they are allowed to do because of the emergence of Sergio Romo. And I like Buster Posey. He won the MVP. He's a good bat. I'd still like to see this team get another hitter. But when your starting rotation goes Lincecum, Kame, Vogelsong, and Bumgarner, watch out. The NL West should have some great pitching matchups this year. Whatever y'all do, do one thing. Keep right.
You have been listening to the Sports Underground Podcast, and you know we always welcome your take. You can find the Sports Underground on Facebook, so go ahead and like it. If you want to download, hit us up on iTunes. And remember, come back again next time and get some.